The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, the role of America's First Lady.
We talk about inclusive history, but if we don't include the story of these women and the contributions that they made as partners to the presidency, then we are not telling our full story.
How it evolved from a ceremonial position to an agent of change. Also, the complex history of sex and Christianity.
In the 11th and 12th century, the Western Church, the Church of the Pope, did something that no other church in history has ever tried, and that is to make all the clergy of the church celibate. Most clergy, before that, would be married.
Professor Diarmaid McCulloch on his new book, which examines millennia of Christian theology. And to begin this evening, the story of the Irish Jacobite Army. For 3 years, from 1689 to 1691, Ireland was a significant theatre in the early stages of a major European war. Multinational armies campaigned across the island, fighting pitched battles and besieging towns and cities. In Ireland, those 3 years are known by a variety of titles, as the Williamite War, the Jacobite War, the War of the Two Kings, and more recently, the War of the Three Kings. The forces involved were immense. In 1690, over 60,000 soldiers were present at the Battle of the Boyne, and a year later, perhaps 40,000 fought at the Battle of Aughrim. At the centre of those battles was the Irish Jacobite Army, a force comprised mostly of Catholic Irish soldiers. To learn more, I'm joined by author and historian Dr. Harmon Murtagh, whose new book, The Irish Jacobite Army, contextualises the varied and remarkable stories of those soldiers and their generals. Harmon, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thank you very much.
Before we discuss the Jacobite Army itself, can you explain to listeners why this European war was being fought in Ireland in the first place?
Well, the causes of the war are often misunderstood or not fully understood. On the one hand, it was an attempt to restore the Catholic King James, who'd been displaced in England. He was King of England, Scotland and Ireland, and the Irish chose to remain loyal to him. That was because he was a Catholic and the Irish Catholics expected much from him. But his throne had been seized in England by his son-in-law and nephew, William of Orange. And William of Orange's motive in doing so was because of his hostility to King Louis XIV, who was by far the dominant power in Europe at the time. So Ireland got dragged into that conflict, if you like. But the Irish had their own interest in it, in that the Irish Catholics had been losers for 100 years or so. They'd lost land, they'd lost wealth, they'd lost their power, they'd lost their influence, they'd lost government jobs, and they'd lost their church, so to speak, because the established church had taken over all the churches and the tithes, the tax that paid for them and so on. So they were hoping for a revival under James. And of course, when James was driven out of England, they therefore had a motive for seeing him returned. As the war wore, James came to Ireland and neither he nor the Irish got on very well with each other. And they were quite glad to see the end of him when he left after the Battle of the Boyne. And from then on, in the latter part of the war, really they were a much more nationalist force. And they bypassed James to appeal to Louis XIV to send a general to take charge of them in the final campaign, which he did.
But one of the huge surprises in all of this is that the Pope was on King Billy's side.
Yes, because Louis XIV was no friend of the Pope, and the Pope was no friend of Louis XIV. So while the Pope wasn't active in Ireland, he wasn't very enthusiastic as a supporter of James. It was said at the time that, you know, thanks was given in Rome, Te Deums were sung in Rome after the defeat at the Boyne. But that's not quite true. The Te Deums were sung in Vienna because the Emperor was William's ally against Louis XIV.
Now, in military terms, how was the conflict different, say, from previous foreign incursions? Say, for example, the Cromwellian invasion in the middle of the 17th century.
Well, the Irish had started off with much greater control of the country. They had didn't control the north, but they controlled Dublin, the capital. And they also had an organised army and a single army, whereas the Confederacy had had four different armies who didn't get on with each other. And also the Confederacy was split between the Gaelic Irish and the descendants of the Normans, the Old English as they were called. Common adversity had eroded a lot of those differences, not entirely, but had eroded a lot of those differences by the end of the 17th century. So you had a single army, a much more united force, and above all, you had a huge input of material, arms, and military experts from France.
And if somebody survived from the 1640s to the 1690s, would they have recognised the armaments? Would they have recognised the military formations of the 1690s?
They largely would have, because these were common to the armies at the time. But the Jacobite army, I would say, was a more professional force than the armies previously. And the leadership was, on the whole, more professional in the sense that there were returned Irish officers, but for the first 2 years of the war, there were 250 French officers in Ireland, providing the kind of support, if you like, perhaps a rough parallel with the Americans in Vietnam before the American forces got involved. Yeah.
Now, those 3 years, the Williamite Jacobite Wars, were exceptionally violent for both soldiers and civilians, and for soldiers on both sides. Mm. Of course, the most famous, the infamous feature of the war, the most famous battle of the war is the Boyne of 1690. But the war was one of many battles and many sieges. Just give us a brief outline of the wider engagements of the war.
Well, the first thing that happened was the Jacobites controlled three quarters of Ireland, but they didn't control Ulster because of the penetration of Scots, especially into Ulster with the Ulster plantation. So they set out to do that. They managed to control East Ulster, but they failed to take Londonderry or Derry and or Enniskillen in West Ulster. And then they were pushed out of Ulster and badly defeated at a battle, quite an important engagement at Newton Butler. So, if you like, the first year of the war was for Ulster, and the Jacobites lost it. King William came then himself in 1690 with reinforcements of every sort for his army in Ireland. And he fought the Battle of the Boyne, he captured Dublin, and he got control of Leinster, and he got control of East Munster. But he was held at Limerick. He wasn't able to take Limerick, thanks to Sarsfield's destruction of his siege train and also because of the spirited defence that the Jacobites put up there. So that was the second year of the war, and that left the Jacobites in control of the west of Ireland behind the Shannon and also of considerable area in Westminster. The third year of the war, a professional Dutch officer commanded the Williamite army, and he attacked the line of the Shannon and eventually got into Connacht and Clare and forced the Jacobites to capitulate at the end of the war.
Oh, that was at the Battle of Aughrim.
That was, yes, after the Battle of Aughrim, yeah. Well, what happened was the French general Saint-Roch rather carelessly lost Athlone, and that allowed the Williamites into the west of Ireland. And the Jacobite army needed the west of Ireland to sustain the army, the countryside, to sustain the army. So Saint-Roch, while he wanted to get his own back for the loss of Athlone and, you know, have a victory, as well as that, if he was going to continue the war, he had to fight to get the Williamites out of Connacht. And he very nearly won the Battle of Aughrim. It's probable that the deciding factor was when a cannonball took off his head and his army was left kind of rudderless in the midst of a crisis moment. And the result was not its entire destruction, but very heavy casualties,
Was James II as inadequate a leader as traditionally depicted?
In Ireland, by and large, yes. But he did have his moments. he seems to have suffered from a sort of mental health problems, perhaps brought on by the stresses of what had occurred to him in England, where his daughters had deserted him and his army had deserted him, and it was general misery and mayhem. And he certainly took control of affairs here with the help of the French ambassador, who was very influential with him, and also Tyrconnell, who was the Irish leader. But he would have periods of doing very little, hunting and saying his prayers and so on. And then he had periods of activity. He was a trained soldier and sailor, and he had commanded the English Navy in battle. So he was no coward, no physical coward. But the Lord Clare, who was an O'Brien, one of the Irish, said after his performance in Ireland, he'd be better to forget trying to lead armies and spend the rest of his days saying his prayers in a monastery. So he wasn't a success in Ireland. And he did shore up the resistance in 1689, when William had sent an army under Marshal Schomberg of about 10,000 men, and they marched down from Ulster and they got bogged down at Dundalk, and James marched up and he stood his ground there, and that was maybe his finest moment in Ireland. But he saw Ireland as a stepping stone to get back to England, and when he saw that wasn't going to happen, he lost interest really in being in Ireland. And I think by 1690, he was just going through the motions, you know.
Now, the Jacobite army wasn't the only Catholic fighting force in the country at that time. Operating across front lines were a group known as the Rapparees.
Yes.
They were kind of a partisan force. Tell me what they did.
Well, they were part exactly that. Well, what happened was, after the Battle of the Boyne, King William said, if any Irish ordinary folk that go back to their homes, they'll be left in peace. And he probably intended that. But his army didn't do that. As they came down into Leinster, and especially as they crossed Leinster to attack Athlone in first time in 1690, the Ulster regiments in particular ignored that and abused the country people to the extent that they turned the country people into rebels. And these guerrillas, partisans, they called them Rapparees at the time, they were a very heavy burden on the Williamites. They massacred stragglers, they stole horses, they interfered with communications. And generally, you can know from the language used about them by the Williamites and the efforts made to control them that they were a considerable force. And the Irish army, now west of the Shannon, realised this, and they sent officers and non-commissioned officers across to, you know, take control and provide leadership, military leadership for the Rapparees. But if the Rapparees were caught, they were strung up. That was it. But the Irish officers and NCOs that came, they came with a certificate from their commanding officer saying, I'm an officer in the Irish army. And they generally survived the experience, yeah.
Now, Irish officers towards the end of the war are in more prominent positions. And the most famous of them all, obviously, you've already mentioned him, is Patrick Sarsfield.
Yeah.
A legendary figure. Do the facts match the legend?
To an extent, they do. He had soldiered on the continent, and then he soldiered in England in the Horse Guards. And he was the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel in the Horse Guards. And he was one of the few soldiers that opposed William in England. Then he comes to Ireland and he's given command of a cavalry regiment. And he's an important, but not a terribly important person in 1689. In 1690, after the Battle of the Boyne, there's a sort of revolt among the Irish officers, the leading Irish officers, led by Sarsfield, in which they're insisting that they take control of events, and they send a deputation to France looking for a French general and so on. And he had a great success when he led a cavalry raid against the Williamite siege train at Ballyneety, and that really thwarted the Williamite attempt to capture Limerick, because William was left without sufficient powder, especially to have a prolonged siege, make a big enough breach in the wall. And when he attacked it, he was driven back. And that Ballyneety raid got, you know, European headlines. So good for Sarsfield's reputation. But after that, when William was gone, Kinkel, the commander he left in Ireland, did a strange thing. He made a midwinter attack on the Shannon, all along and on Kerry, in various places. And so it was Sarsfield that organised the defence, the successful defence of the West against that attack. So that was very much to his credit. When Samru came, he begins to drop. You know, you don't hear much about him. But after Samru's death, he's the leading Irish soldier. And even though there are French generals still left who outrank him, nonetheless, he's really calling the shots. And the Williamites, you know, constantly worrying and fussing about what Sarsfield is going to do and so on, they obviously rated him very highly. But after he went to France, he was killed in France after a couple of years. He served under Marshal Luxembourg, one of the greatest soldiers in Europe at the time. And Marshal Luxembourg said this about him. He said, told Louis XIV that he had particularly noticed the valour and fearlessness of which Sarsfield has given proof in Ireland. I can assure your Majesty, he is a very good and a very able officer. That's quoting Luxembourg. Coming from such a distinguished soldier, that's praise indeed.
Now, Ockram, the Battle of Ockram, I suppose the deciding moment of the war. Is it the battle with the most fatalities of any battle fought in Ireland?
It probably is, yeah. The Williamites lost about 2,000. They claimed, many Williamites claimed this, or several of them anyway, that the Jacobites lost as many as 7,000. One Jacobite account says we lost 2,000 casualties, now not counting prisoners. And King James's memoirs, which were written in France, but by a team that probably included people who'd served in the war in Ireland, they admit to 4,000 casualties killed. So that's about between the 2 and the 7. It could be around that. It might be right. It's hard to say, you know.
Obviously, it was a disaster also for thousands of camp followers. This is something you also cover in the book, who accompanied the army. Who were the camp followers?
Well, these are the wives and children of the soldiers. They moved around with the army and had to be fed and accommodated to some extent as well. The only time they became involved in combat was during the Siege of Limerick, when they hurled broken bottles at the advancing Williamite soldiers. At Ockram, a Danish soldier who wrote an account mentions that when the Jacobite army was broken and fleeing and the dead were all over the place, and he says he never saw so much blood in his life and so on, he said the lanes were filled with wailing women. And when, and this is an extraordinary statement, but when the Irish soldiers went to France after the war, the French officials in the ports that were receiving the Irish soldiers said, they've come with wives and children, they said, and the officers have maybe 10 and 11 children with them, and the soldiers 5 or 6. Well, if that's true, presumably the same number were tramping round after the army in Ireland.
After Ockham, the Jacobites flee to Limerick. How did they manage to avoid annihilation and manage to effectively leave Ireland, the Jacobite army or the remnants of the Jacobite army, intact?
Well, Limerick is an extraordinarily difficult place to besiege because the River Shannon runs down, and the core of Limerick is called the English Town in those days, was built on an island, and two branches of the Shannon go around the island. And to cross the Shannon was difficult. So William only besieged it from the east side, from the County Limerick side. Kinkel started doing that in 1691, and he did manage eventually to cross over to the west side with some, or get some forces over to the west side. But Kinkel was Dutch, and he wanted to see the war in Ireland ended, no matter what, because he wanted the Williamite army to move to Flanders, where it could, you know, fight on behalf of the Dutch. So he was anxious to end the war. Meanwhile, in Limerick, Sarsfield is waiting for a promise of further assistance from France in the form of food and military supplies. And there's no sign of these to arrive. And the food is running out, and they've worked out that it'll have run out by in 3 weeks' time or a month's time. So finally Sarsfield says, or agrees, that we must bargain now while we've something left to bargain with, because if we've no food left, we just have to surrender. An army can't fight with no food. So therefore he enters into negotiations, and he has, Ginkell's anxious to end the war, Sarsfield is still in control of Limerick, so there is something to negotiate with. And the Sarsfield at this stage is thinking of moving to France, and so the arrangement is, if the Irish soldiers want to go home, they go home and live in peace. If the Irish landowners, who are still in resistance in the army or under its protection, if they want to go home, they can go back to their estates and they'll be allowed to keep them. If the Irish soldiers want to go to France, Ginkell will provide the transport, the shipping to get them there to end the war. So that was the deal.
Pretty good deal.
A pretty good deal. So it seemed. It wasn't that well drafted for the civilians. And, you know, the result was the penal laws. And certainly you could say it was dishonoured in the spirit. It's rather more difficult to pinpoint it being dishonoured in the letter, but it is, to some extent, that is true. However, 5,000 soldiers had gone to France already in 1690. And now another 15,000 or so went with Sarsfield. So there were about 20,000 Irish soldiers in France.
And these are the famous wild geese.
These are the wild geese, yeah. Mm.
Now, the book has extraordinary detail within its pages, but it also has a long history of its own, and one that starts with your co-author, your father.
My co-author, yes. My father had served in the LDF during the war, and he's very interested in military history. And he's one of the founders of the Military History Society of Ireland. So he started writing his PhD on the Jacobite Army. And sadly, he died before his time, before it was complete. And I was only a little boy of 11 then. But I was already inculcated into the Jacobite Army. And so it was an ambition of mine to finish it for him. And I read history in Trinity with Dr. Sims, as both as an undergraduate and postgraduate. And of course, he was a great expert in Jacobite Ireland, Gerald Sims. And so I finished the book eventually.
A labour of love, and we're very grateful for it indeed. Dr. Hammond Murta, many thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening to talk about the Irish Jacobite Army, published by Four Courts Press.
Thank you very much.
And after the break, we'll be hearing about the lives and legacies of the First Ladies of the United States. Stay with us. Welcome back. In American history, the role of the First Lady, the spouse of the President, which has to date always been a woman, has evolved from a largely ceremonial position to one of significant influence. Many of these women have shaped US government policy and led social movements. Colin Flynn now takes a closer look at this American institution and how it has transformed over time from the early days of Martha Washington.
We knew we had to fill a gap in academic literature, and then we talk about history in our country, in the United States. We talk about inclusive history, but if we don't include the story of these women and the contributions that they made as partners to the presidency, then we are not telling our full story.
Anita McBride was the chief of staff of the White House for Laura Bush between 2005 and 2009.
George always says he's delighted to come to these press dinners. Baloney.
Now she's published a book entitled U.S. First Ladies, Making History and Leaving Legacies, looking at the lives of America's first ladies, going all the way back to the Washingtons in 1789.
George Washington understood from the beginning, when he became president, that his new role as president of a new United States was a two-person job.
For Martha Washington, her role in that two-person job was undefined. So really they had to decide what the role of the president's wife was as they went along. She'd been born in 1731 in Virginia, and before her marriage to George Washington, she was a wealthy widow who managed a large estate. So when George Washington was elected as the nation's first president, he was now head of government, but also head of state, a role he decided to delegate to his wife, Martha.
And lucky for him, because she was a very experienced hostess. So the role of diplomacy and how now the burden of setting precedent for this role was Martha Washington.
And we take it so much for granted now, the role of the First Lady. But back then, there was no such title even of First Lady. She was Lady Washington.
That's right. She was Lady Washington.
The title of First Lady didn't even appear until 1849 at the funeral of First Lady Dolly Madison. She was the wife of James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, and was really the first to use hospitality at the White House as a tool for diplomacy.
She felt as this new nation, our nation, the United States, was being built, it was important for it to be seen for at a level of stature equal to many countries around the world that were more established and didn't know what to make of this new democratic republic where actually the people are in charge and not a monarchy.
Dolly Madison would invite opposing political sides to the White House for functions and social events, always making sure that everyone saw her, but more importantly, that she got to see and talk to everyone else.
And she'd make herself, if I can say, she'd make herself known in the rooms that were so filled with people. They were actually called squeezes because you had to squeeze yourself in there. But she would wear very colorful clothes and wear a big turban with a big plume. And she would work the room. She would find out pieces of information. She would bring that information to her husband. You know, her husband appreciated, President Madison appreciated her social graces, but it was truly her political astuteness that he valued.
And Anita, I'm wondering, was it always welcomed? Because you think of societal norms of the time and women being told to stay in your place, and her husband is the elected official, she is not.
Great question. I think the fact that there still is no position description to this day in 2024, so it's a very fine line that a first lady has always in our country had to walk. And when they have crossed it, it didn't always go over very well. I mean, certainly the most powerful of all first ladies in our history was Edith Wilson, who for 17 months really ran the government behind the scenes while her husband, who had had a bad stroke, you know, was recuperating. And we would never see anything like this in modern times, of course, the extreme overreach in terms of power.
After the 25th president of the United States, William McKinley, was shot dead, the third U.S. president to be assassinated, it was his vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, at the age of only 42, became the youngest person ever to take the presidency.
I believe again that the American people are as a whole capable of self-control and of learning by their mistakes.
His wife, Edith, was reluctant to take on so much responsibility, but would end up making one of the greatest contributions to the role. At the beginning of the 20th century, when we talk about Edith Roosevelt, tell me a bit about her and her impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, Edith Roosevelt was the first lady of the 20th century. She moves into the White House with five rambunctious children. The White House at the time was still home and office, the actual White House structure itself. And so there was no room for the president and his staff to be on the same floor anymore. So she was really a driving force behind resurrecting plans that had been there but never executed on to expand the White House, create an office wing. This is what we now know today as the West Wing and later an Oval Office. The behind-the-scenes influence she had in being a conduit of information for her husband during the Russo-Japanese War with a British diplomat in St. Petersburg that was sending her information that was valuable to Teddy Roosevelt and going through back channels and not official channels so the information would be protected. And of course, as we know, Teddy Roosevelt wins the Nobel Peace Prize for his successful efforts in negotiating that war, but we like to think Edith Roosevelt had a lot to do with helping him.
It's incredible how, you know, many of the first ladies embrace the role, make it their own. Do we have any examples, Anita, of first ladies who their husband becomes president, but they're the politician, they're the ones who've fought all their life for this, and the First Lady isn't that interested or is overwhelmed or just isn't cut out for it.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt was one. She did not want to become First Lady. She had a very successful a career of her own already, and she felt that she would be constrained in the role.
From New York City, Eleanor Roosevelt lost her parents and became an orphan at the age of 10. She was the First Lady from 1933 to 1945 and was the first to really use her power and influence for activism, especially around civil and women's rights.
First of all, she was writing a daily column. She had a weekly radio broadcast. This is all before she came to the White House. She was a political activist.
Was she able to keep that going, Anita, when she went into the White House?
Great question on that, because the president did not want her to have a very public role. She wanted to continue to do
it. In case it damaged him?
Well, you know, again, let's think about, you know, women's role in society. Some of her policies and interests, particularly on human rights and civil rights, were not necessarily his, and not necessarily ones that his advisors thought would be winning policies. Now, we know, of course, she is known to be a champion of civil rights and human rights.
To make people everywhere conscious of the importance of human rights and freedoms.
She found a way to become so well-known, so well-liked, so active, including having press conferences only for women.
And she was making so much noise that she even had the KKK, who were out for her as well.
Yes, exactly, particularly her activism.
In 1938, while attending a conference in Birmingham, Alabama, whites were instructed to sit on one side of the hall and blacks on the other.
The group that was hosting her had her seated with the whites. She refused to do that. She had her chair moved to the middle of the aisle so that she was not showing favoritism to one or the other. Small gesture, but big impact.
But we talk about now today viral moments.
Yes.
I mean, of the day, that must have been an incredible moment.
That was a moment basically saying, you know, what was right versus what was wrong.
We must want our fellow human beings to have rights and freedoms which give them dignity.
Mrs. Nixon, just how do you feel starting out on another campaign?
They're always exciting, and the one that started in New Hampshire couldn't have been more so.
And Anita, I want to ask you about who you believe is one of the most underrated first ladies in history, and that is Mrs. Nixon.
Pat Nixon was a very active and engaged First Lady.
Well, these are very exhausting experiences.
I've done it so many times that I don't, and also my heart is in it. I'm a willing volunteer.
Is the most traveled First Lady in history, 81 countries. During a earthquake in Peru, about 2 years into the presidency of President Nixon, she travels there after a devastating earthquake nearly killed nearly half the population.
Mrs. Nixon, the people of Peru, they are conscious of what you have done for them.
But yet she went there and she brought these supplies, brought the compassion and generosity of the American people.
And I want to say this to the television audience. I made my mistakes.
And yet, you know, it's the issues of Watergate that really overshadowed all of her contributions.
Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything.
And all she had done for people with disabilities as well. And she used to say, people are my project, isn't that right?
Yes, she did. And in fact, on all of her foreign travels that I mentioned, she always wanted a schedule that was people who were marginalized and needed her voice. And that's the one thing she did to the White House, too, is made, well, long before there was an Americans with Disabilities Act, she's the one that installed the ramps in the White House for people, tours for the blind, tours at night for women who were working and coming into the workforce. I mean, she really, it was a remarkable First Lady.
I think the most difficult task of all is to be surrounded all the time. You don't have enough what I call blessed aloneness.
Anita, we could talk about this all day, but we'll finish with one that's close to the hearts of Irish people. John F. Kennedy, of course, his wife Jacqueline Kennedy. Tell me a bit about her role as First Lady, as short as it was.
As a 31-year-old woman who comes into the White House reluctantly, not really liking politics, was not an activist First Lady, certainly, but she chose an issue that her husband did not want her to do. Going back to your other question about historic preservation, he thought it would be perceived as elitist, but she pursued this. Her protection, preservation of the White House, creating the White House Historical Association, which you know, our mutual friend Stuart McLaren, opened up the White House to people through a televised interview. More Americans saw the White House on that February 14th, 1962 than they had ever seen before.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
And of course, tragically organizing that state funeral for her husband.
And this, the funeral, of course, you know, of course, she watches her husband murdered in front of her eyes, and within a number of days, of course, orchestrates and leads and plans a state funeral that allowed the country to grieve and to watch this young family in her stoicism and her strength and grace, to allow the country to really honor her husband. She worried what his legacy would be. She was already hearing, you know, murmurs that there was not much that he had accomplished. She made it her business to preserve his legacy in full story of John F. Kennedy.
All of you who have written to me know how much we all loved him, and that he returned that love in full measure.
Anita McBride, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Colm. I've enjoyed this a lot.
And that was Colin Flynn reporting there. He was talking to Anita McBride about the lives and legacies of America's first ladies. And after the break, I'll be joined by Professor Diarmaid McCulloch, author of the new book Lower Than the Angels, A History of Sex and Christianity. Stay with us. Welcome back. Now we're looking at the complex history of sex and Christianity. The new book, Lower Than the Angels, is a historical exploration of the religion's complex relationship with gender, sex and sexuality. It's written by the historian, author and also church organist, apparently on most Sundays, Diarmaid McCulloch, who is professor of the history of the church at Oxford University. And I'm sure you will also be familiar with Diarmaid from a variety of BBC series on history. Diarmaid joins me on the line now. You're very welcome indeed, Diarmaid, to the History Show.
Thank you. Very good to talk.
Now, this is a book which covers a lot of history. We're talking 3,000 years from the ancient roots of Christianity itself right up to the present day. But it's also a very personal story for you. You were essentially a priest in waiting many years back. You have described yourself as having the L plates of a priest in waiting. What happened?
That's an informal description of what a deacon in the Church of England normally is. It's generally a sort of year of preparation before you get ordained to the next stage, which is priesthood. Well, what happened was that the church really couldn't cope with me and couldn't cope with the fact I'd been honest about sexuality. As a gay man with a partner, I wanted to go into an institution which proclaims truth in a truthful way. And so I didn't hide this fact about me, which is really rather important. And you, as a you go into priesthood presenting yourself as truthful as you can, but the church couldn't cope. This was the late 1980s. It was in the middle of a vast internal struggle about sexuality.
You did hope, I think, that some members of the Church of England hierarchy might have supported your stand, but that's not how it turned out.
Well, some did. And the church is a very varied organisation full of fallible people and some more fallible than others. So I did experience a lot of support and sympathy within the church. But the trouble was, I'm a very politically naive person. And I suppose that going into this process of ordination, scrutiny and moving towards priesthood involved being totally straightforward about myself to the authorities. And the authorities couldn't find a way of dealing with that at the time when a lot of conservative pressure was coming on the bishops to hold the line, hold traditional lines on sexuality, such as the traditional lines were.
Now, you are both obviously a Christian, you're an academic historian studying the history of the church. When it comes to the Bible, the text, do you see the Bible as the Word of God, or is it a multi-authored historical text?
Well, I think you're leading me to the answer you expect there. The Bible is a collection of books. It's not a book. We see it normally between covers as a single volume, you know, with black Bible black covers. But it's not like that. Within those covers are a huge range of books from different periods, different eras, with different preoccupations, each of which is an attempt to grapple with the vast problem, the joy, the astonishment of the divine. And so the Bible is not the Word of God. The Word of God is Jesus. Jesus is the Word of God because the Bible says so. In the beginning of John's Gospel, it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh." That shows you what the Word of God is. It's Jesus. And so we are all, including the writers in the Bible, looking at the fascinating problem of the divine and Jesus's appearance as part of the divine, an extraordinary, baffling idea which Christians have had to struggle with over 2,000 years.
Now, very early on in the book, you describe Christianity essentially as a 3,000-year rather than a 2,000-year project. I would have thought by definition that Christianity was a, 2,024-year project at this stage.
You would think that, but this is a thought which came to me in the bath, like all good ideas do in the bath. And it was when I was trying to think of a puzzle my way to a title for my previous huge book on the entire history of Christianity. And I realized you can't start with the birth of Jesus Christ. You have to put that in the context of 1,000 years before that, and in fact, two different 1,000 years, is, if you see what I mean. One is a Jewish 1,000 years, and the other is a Greek 1,000 years, and both these feed ideas to create the synthesis which focuses on Christ, yes, but is the product of these two different cultures. And that's what this book is trying to do the same thing with again.
Now, when we think about what you might call the Christian theology of sex or traditional marriage, many think of it as being something that has been fairly constant over the last 2,000 years. You argue, though, that is not the case. There's a wonderful phrase which comes up in the book, that marriage has traditionally been a contract between two men. Can you elaborate on that one for me?
Yes. This is a simple fact of life, not just in Christianity, but in cultures across the world. The two men involved are the father of the bride and the father of the groom. They arrange a marriage, and the opinions of the young people, though they should come into it, are secondary to that. Marriage traditionally has been a family discussion, a family agreement, a dynastic agreement at most levels. And that's so different from the way that the West now treats marriage. You know, when I was a boy long ago, there was a popular song, "Love and Marriage Go Together Like Horse and Carriage." That really isn't the case historically. These are two different things, and we now try and associate them in marriages, often with not terribly good results. I'm not saying it was a bad idea that marriage was once family alliance. It was a different way of doing marriage, and it involved different assumptions about what marriage is.
And you also point out that for centuries, the church regarded marriage as a less valid option.
Yeah, it was messy. It was to do with sex and physicality. And that really wasn't the church's business. I mean, the killer fact about that is that in the early church, the church of the first 5 centuries or so, there was no such thing as a wedding in church. We think of confetti and bells or whatever. That simply didn't happen. That's something which gradually crept into the church, starting in the 5th century. But if you're looking at Ireland, say, it really doesn't start until the 11th or the 12th century of the Christian era. So that means that for more than half the existence of the church, the two millennia of the church's history, there was no such thing as a church wedding in an Irish context. And I have been astonished by the fact that the clergy, the hierarchy of the church, I'm thinking particularly of the Church of England, don't seem to know that basic fact. At the present day, they are locked in a fierce battle as to whether people of the same sex can get married in church. Well, I think it rather sort of shakes the debate up a bit if you realise that this isn't a first-order problem for the church.
Now, Christianity may be a 3,000-year project, but apparently celibacy is only a 1,000-year project and is related really to property, to church property.
Well, yeah, again, if we focus on Ireland, the Western Church, which created the Catholic Church of modern times, celibacy became a unique project within this Western Church. There had been celibacy from the early days of the Church, and the development of monasteries and monks and nuns within the Church, which is a sort of second century of the Christian era phenomenon. That's one thing. But in the 11th and 12th century, the Western Church, the Church of the Pope, did something that no other church in history has ever tried, and that is to make all the clergy of the church celibate. Most clergy before that would be married. And there was a terrible struggle between the married clergy and the celibate clergy in the 11th and 12th centuries, most of which is hidden from us, because for the moment, the celibate clergy won. And you can say that jumping to the 16th century and the Reformation, that's one of the issues which triggered it. And that the Protestants reinstated traditional clerical identity, which was a married identity.
And some took the issue of celibacy to extremes. Tell me about the 18th century Russian Orthodox peasant prophet Kondraty Selivanov.
Yes, he was a rather familiar figure in Russian Orthodoxy, a wandering mystic who looked at the Bible intensely in his own way. Unfortunately, he misread bits of the Bible. Where the text says, be fruitful, he read, castrate yourselves. And so his followers, his male followers, cut their genitals off, and women mutilated their breasts. The sect which he created was called the Skoptsi, and it survived from the 18th century a very long time, possibly till after the Second World War, because the authorities hated it. But what could they do? These people had already horribly mutilated themselves, so they weren't going to be really afraid of any punishment that the Tsars or the Soviets could inflict on them. Apparently, the Skoptsi were noted for being coachmen. You employed Skopsy coachmen in Eastern Europe and Russia. Don't ask me why. But that's one of the extreme examples of what happens if you intensely look at the Bible, probably in the wrong way.
One of the first things you address is the history of the angel, basically, the history of angelic gender identification. Have angels traditionally been categorized by sex or gender, or are they generally seen as sexless?
Not in the Bible. They are very sexy in the Bible, and they're very male. In the book of Genesis, for instance, you've got to keep your women away from them because they kept copulating with ladies and producing offspring. And even the Apostle Paul says to his new Christian congregations when he's creating the new church in the Mediterranean, women must cover their heads for the sake of the angels. Not quite clear what he's talking about, but I think it reflects this idea that angels are in fact rather emphatically male. So the Bible doesn't make angels sexless at all. It's a later Christian idea, and you begin seeing it in the 4th century. You see it in Christian art. And that's the first time, and this is another sort of forgotten fact, that's the first time that angels had wings. They don't have wings in the Bible. There are supernatural beings who have wings who are called cherubim and seraphim, but they're not angels. So suddenly in the 4th century, angels got wings. And they also seem to be increasingly less male, but a bit male, if you see what I mean. Now, that clearly is intentional. What's going on? Why is that? Because now monasteries were big in the growing Christian church. And monks, in particular, were looking for a role model. Monks were male, but they didn't want to be too male, for obvious reasons, they're celibates. So they decided that a very good image for themselves was being like angels, these new, rather unsexy angels with wings, but actually no beards. Angels had beards in art before the 4th century, 5th century. But interestingly, two groups of Christians were contending to be like angels. You had the monks, but you also had eunuchs. Eunuchs, big feature of Byzantine society, the late Roman Empire. Eunuchs were courtiers, they were imperial generals, eventually they were even patriarchs of Constantinople. And they rather liked the idea of being angels too. So there's a sort of rhetorical tussle around who is most like an angel in the early church.
You also highlight the absence of references to, and therefore condemnation of, homosexuality in the Gospels. So remind me of the 12th century legend which was created to account for that lack of condemnation.
Yeah, Jesus says absolutely nothing about homosexuality, whatever that might mean. But in the 12th century, with this growing insistence on celibacy and monks and clergy being extremely nervous about their own sexual impulses, a great growth in what we might call homophobia started. And one of the worst homophobic legends was created, sometime towards the end of the 12th century by someone we don't know. And it was a story about Christmas. And the story was that little baby Jesus, who hadn't been born yet, refused to come into the world until all the sodomites had been killed. And so God duly massacred all the sodomites in the world. And so little baby Jesus could go on to the manger in Bethlehem after that. And this is a bizarre story, absolutely no basis for it before that. And yet you see it in the preaching of friars, the great preachers of the medieval church, for Christmas Day. Can you imagine a sermon on Christmas Day about massacring sodomites? And you don't tend to get that story much in school nativity plays these days, I imagine.
You emphasise that in Greek, Roman and Jewish society, quote, public power was organised for the benefit of free adult males. That doesn't precisely or doesn't exactly come across as a huge surprise. Did women have any real status in those societies?
Well, they did. They had their particular domestic status, that the home was their place. They had skills which men didn't have, usually like cooking, weaving, that sort of thing. But their role was emphatically, in public society, it was secondary to men. Now, the early church, the first Christians, did do something about that because they created an entirely new way of identifying those within the church from the Jews. The Jews had circumcision. And that is a male thing. You do it to males. It wasn't about female circumcision. So in other words, being a Jew was defined by something male, whereas Christianity was defined by something entirely new, baptism. This washing into the church, cleansing of sin, yes, but it's a physical thing. You are, water is poured over you with appropriate words. And that's something you can do to women as well as men. That's the revolutionary thing about Christianity, taking the church away from Jewish tradition to something new. Now, the church didn't really keep that significance in mind. Men took over in the leading roles gradually from the first to the third century. But there it is. There it is still. Baptism is what makes a Christian, and baptism is something either men or women or whatever gender definition there is, they're all baptized.
Now, finally, you've written a 700-odd or almost 700-page book about sex and Christianity, a very sensitive, controversial topic. Are you expecting a fundamentalist backlash in an increasingly vituperative world?
Yes, I think there will be some, but the problem is that they can't just say this is all nonsense, you don't know anything about it, because about 200 of those 700 pages you've named are footnotes. These are quotations. I'm trying simply to present the facts. And you can't quarrel with historical truth. You've got to debate the details of it, yeah. But people will still go on being very cross about the book. I can see conservative Roman Catholics being very cross about it. I can see conservative evangelical Protestants being very cross about it. But I can also see a lot of people who've been very damaged by Christianity being cross that I've not put the boot in enough to the church. I've been too kind to it. So these three groups will all converge on me, where, you know, waving flaming torches, and et cetera. And I hope they'll fight each other when they get there before they take their axes to me.
Well, don't forget to duck when the fire and brimstone starts flying, Dermot. The book is called Lower Than the Angels, A History of Sex and Christianity, covering three millennia of Christian and pre-Christian history, published by Alan Lane. The author is my guest, Professor Dermot McCulloch. Dermot, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening.
Being a pleasure to talk.
And that's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Pather Carney on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.